Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell here today with Russ Chianelli in the studio. And we're going to be talking to a Professor Sarah Seeger. She is an astrophysicist from MIT up there in Massachusetts. And she's doing wonderful things and thinking wonderful outlandish things about other forms of life, et cetera, et cetera. But before we get to that, Sarah, are you there?
I'm here, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get into the science part, let's go back a little bit when Sarah was a young girl or a young lady. What was it that sort of stimulated you to look for and get a successful career in science?
Well, although I never started out to want a career in science and astrophysics, I always loved the stars and the night sky. I remember being a small child and driving with my father in the car, and I'd see the moon, and, you know, the moon was always following me. I just didn't understand why he turned left or right or drove forever, it seemed, and the moon was always there. And one time, he took me to a star party, and that's not, you know, like full of Hollywood movie stars. It's where amateur astronomers get together and point their telescopes at objects for the public to view. And I must have been about 5 years old, and I really remember looking through the telescope and, wow, the moon. It had craters and details that were just absolutely astonishing. Like, I had already, you know, been watching the moon from the car, and, like, I just was so amazed that it was like a world unto itself. So I have a series of memories like that that just were very, very sporadic but stuck with me.
So then that was the beginning.
I mean, that was the beginning, but I have one more really important memory, and that was around about age, I want to say 10, I went on a camping trip. It was my dad's first and last camping trip, but one summer we had a babysitter. His name was Tom, and he was, like, not too much older than the rest of us. He was, I'd say, around 14. And he insisted we should all try camping. So he borrowed his family's stuff and took us on a camping trip. And I remember stepping outside the tent in the middle of the night, not being able to sleep, and going out there. And, wow, I looked up, and it must have been a moonless night, and it was in the middle of nowhere. And I just saw so many stars. I mean, no one had ever told me about this. I just, like, I felt like I was the first one ever to witness it. And I just was amazed with it.
That reminds me when I first came to West Texas. I come from England originally. And so we see the Big Dipper. Certainly we can see that in Britain. But there's so much light pollution and always a cloud and lots of water vapor. And then when I came out here, and in fact with a cousin that was from Toronto, and he's a physicist, and we both went out into the desert, looked up. There was so much there, and I couldn't figure out where the Big Dipper was.
You know,
there was just so much there, and it's quite remarkable.
And I wish all the listeners could find a way to see a dark sky if they haven't already.
So tell us, Sarah, what that was 5 and 10. Obviously, you went to school. You went to the University of Toronto and studied astrophysics?
I did, but before that, I was in high school, my local public school. And something interesting happened. I was studying physics, which I didn't take to very easily, honestly. I found it a bit kind of confusing at first. But one time, somewhere about halfway through the class, we had an experiment to do where the teacher held a board, like a wooden board with a big hole cut in it, and each student had to stand one by one at the other end of the classroom. And we had known the equations, worked out some of the equations of motion, and we had a spring. And we had to measure, we had to figure out how springy the spring was and actually choose which equation we needed, and knowing the distance, which angle we had to shoot the spring at. Now, I think for a lot of people, you could just use intuition and shoot the spring and it would go there, but we were supposed to use the physics we had learned all up until that point. So about a third of the class managed to get this right, and when it was my turn, I stood up there with all my calculations and had the spring, and I shot it, and it went in. And I was like, I couldn't believe you could write an equation down and then apply that equation to the world around you. And lo and behold, it was almost like magic. Like, I was so shocked. And so it was like a great turning point now looking back that I realized that all the stuff we were learning wasn't just random and abstract, but there was actually, you know, very useful application. So later on, when I went to university, I was able to take astronomy, which I always loved. And I was able to use physics, you know? I actually learned you could be an astronomer for a job and apply both physics and astronomy to the world around us.
And then that was it. You decided that you wanted to carry on and be an astronomer, of astrophysicist, for a career.
I did, because I was, like, a couple of years after that classroom event. Remember, I grew up in Toronto, right in the city. literally probably a quarter of a mile away from the University of Toronto. And so I would walk through the campus sometimes on my way to high school. And I saw a sign for an open house. I'm sure that your university also does this. You have like open houses to kind of show people what's there and recruit new students. So I went there. I remember it was open on a Saturday, and I went in this very tall building and went up to the floor the astronomers were on. And they had pamphlets. They were like professors and students. And I just couldn't believe it. They told me that you could be an astronomer for a job. Like, it was actually a job people could do. And this was really, it was just as astonishing as the other incidents I recounted to you. So I went home to see my dad. I was like, I can't believe this. I can be an astronomer for a job. Whoever knew about this? And I was so thrilled about this discovery. And all my dad said was, no. No, you cannot do that. That is not suitable. And being a parent myself now, I understand where he was coming from. I think he wanted to see his children grow up and have a job he didn't have to.
Was there some aspect of that fact that you were a girl?
Yes, actually, because he, through his own family experience, he knew that especially for girls. I mean, men are expected to go out and get a job. He knew especially for girls, because in his generation earlier, for girls, it depended on who they marry. He didn't want my life to depend on who I married. If the person was a good or bad character or earning a lot of money or not, he wanted me to make my own fortune. And he said, look, Sarah, you have to be able to get a job and support yourself and not rely on any man.
Listen, I have another question. When you looked at the moon and you see a crater up there, did it worry you that an asteroid was going to hit Earth sometime? Did you ever think about that? I know it always affected me, and I went around and looked and traveled to the place where the big impactors hit the Earth.
Well, I'll say that at age 5, no. I definitely wasn't thinking about what those craters even were, actually. But when I was older and learned what they were, I wasn't worried, right? Because we have so many lakes in Canada, many, many lakes that look like a perfect circle, actually. And people now believe that, you know, meteor hit it and created the lake. So no, I don't think it, I wasn't worried, because I guess by then I had learned that this period of bombardment was a long, long time ago. And although stuff can still happen now, it's somewhat unlikely.
I'd never heard that. So you're saying all those beautiful lakes up there, or Huronia, are all, in theory, coming from meteorites hitting I thought it was just glaciation.
Not all of them. I'd say it's probably a very tiny fraction of them, but there's enough of them.
Uh-huh.
Like, some people think that Hudson's Bay, for example, was created by one, and there's these lakes called Clearwater Lakes in western Quebec, and in northern Quebec there is a definitive, like, perfect circle.
Yeah, Hudson's Bay has always stuck out on a map as being a little bizarre, right?
Right, but there are, like, several little small lakes that people now think
okay.
are from that. But I wasn't worried about that.
Isn't the moon part of a chunk of the Earth going way back?
It is. Mm-hmm. The moon
separated
is
from
the
Earth.
Yeah, by a glancing blow early on.
Let's get on to what you do. So here you are. You went to Toronto. You got your bachelor's degree. Did you get a PhD there also?
I didn't. I actually went to Harvard for my PhD.
All right. So that's going up in the world. And then from Harvard, what did you do for your thesis, your dissertation at Harvard?
Well, believe it or not, when I was at Harvard in the mid-1990s, exoplanets orbiting sun-like stars were first discovered. And I actually had just finished up a project at Harvard. They required us to do like a preliminary project before we could move on to the PhD, and I was literally looking for a new project. And my advisor at the time, it's really kind of unheard of. It's not usually normal that you give a student such a risky project, but he said, hey, you know, there are these new planets that were discovered. We know about 4 of them now. There was just some very small number of them. Why don't you study these planets, and you can use the computer codes you've already written and apply it to these so-called hot Jupiters, planets about the mass of Jupiter, but orbiting so close to the star. They're orbiting like several times closer to their star than Mercury is to our sun. And he said you could work out what the atmosphere is going to look like, that maybe we could observe it one day, and things like that.
Were these exoplanets, the discovery was at that period, Who made the first observation of an exoplanet?
Well, you know, when you look back, it's a little more complicated than that, because people had been looking for these planets for a long time, and so they maybe see them in the older data sets. But what happened was, in 1995, a pair of Swiss astronomers, Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz, announced the discovery of 51 Peg B. That's a sun-like star called 51 Peg, and this planet, which was just called 51 Peg B, lowercase b, orbiting around it. And apparently they had found evidence of a planet a year earlier, but it was so crazy. It was orbiting in only 4 days, where it takes our Jupiter 12 years to go around its sun, so unexpected that they waited a long time before they were ready to make the announcement to the world. So that was announced in 1995. Meanwhile, there were a pair of American astronomers who had been taking data for a very long time, and they looked in their data and they saw 51 Peg B right away, because they weren't looking for four-day period signals. And then they looked more and they found more. And so right away there were about four or five exoplanets found.
Oh, that's interesting. And tell me, why is it Peg and then lowercase b? What? Why lowercase? Why uppercase? How do people come up with these names, if you like, for these exoplanets?
Well, these exoplanets, so I guess exoplanets weren't really known before that time. At least there were a few known around pulsars, a kind of really dead star. But we know we already had the International Astronomical Union, the sort of governing body, already had a scheme to describe binary stars. Many stars appear in pairs. They're gravitationally bound to each other.
Right.
Orbiting their common center of mass, and usually they're called A and B, capital A, capital B. Like, for example, our nearest stars, Alpha Centauri, there's an A and a B. There's also a third star in the system, but there's A and B. So they couldn't give it a capital letter, because that would be, like, for a binary, that would be confusing. So it just got lowercase letter,
right,
and it just stuck. It is a bit confusing, because they're named in the order of discovery. So there are some multiple planet systems where it's not going from inner planet to outer planet, B, C, D, E, but it's more jumbled up according to which were found first.
Yes, a little confusing, but never mind. So now, what are you doing up there at MIT, Sarah? I know you're involved with this new telescope that's going to be up there soon. Why don't you talk a little bit about that particular project?
Are you referring to TESS?
No, I can't remember the name. There's a new... it's a new telescope going up there that's
something
going to take over from
Hubble,
but I can't remember the name of the telescope.
Okay, sure. Well, what I'd like you to know right now is that since I started working on exoplanets over 20 years ago, the field has incredibly flourished. You know, we know of thousands of planets now. It's a well-established field. There's several different techniques that find planets. And the one that I'd say most people now are focusing on, including a number of different space missions, are on the so-called transiting planets. These are planets that go in front of a star as seen from Earth or as seen from the telescope. And right now, that's our easiest way to find planets. And so you could call it like all the rage. So right now, we have the mission Kepler. Like a lot of people have heard of Kepler. It's a basically a one-meter space telescope that's been observing the sky for a number of years, and it's found thousands and thousands of planets. Because you know what? Earth's atmosphere is very blurry. It blurs our vision of the stars. You know how stars twinkle? Well, if you could go to space, stars don't twinkle. And that's actually really, really helpful for looking for transiting planets, because you have to measure the brightness of a star with high precision as a function of time. Like every few seconds or minutes, you take an image of a star, essentially. And when you see a planet go in front of the starlight drops by the tiniest amount. And so that's actually how we find most planets now. So here at MIT, we're leading a NASA mission. It's called TESS, like the girl's name TESS, Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And TESS, it really builds on this pioneering Kepler Space Telescope. And it's basically, you know, it has, you can think of it as got four identical cameras that are essentially glorified telephoto lenses. And each of these lenses is about, I want to say, 10 centimeters in diameter, so it's not very big. But all four together actually look at a very large part of the sky. They look at a 20 by 90 degree strip of the sky. So if you think about, like, our Earth, like a latitude-longitude system projected on the sky, you know, 90 degrees is, like, from your equator up to your pole. So it's like a giant strip of the sky at one time. And it'll look at that strip for about a month, and then it will move on to another strip, tiling the southern hemisphere first, and the next year tiling the whole northern hemisphere.
So the analysis of all that data takes a lot longer than the actual acquisition of the data.
That's a really interesting point. So I wanted to just back up and give one thing, that for a planet to go in front of its star, as seen by us, it has to have a very special alignment, because there's no reason a planet should be orbiting to go in front of the star. Maybe it's orbiting around the star, like in a circle projected on the sky. So you have to look at so many stars just to get the ones that are fortuitously aligned. But you know what? What's really funny to hear you say that is, initially, we will try to keep up with the data. So we'll try to analyze the data pretty much as quickly as it's taken, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
But ultimately, people use it like, it's, you can imagine it like a library. Like, people will keep using the data and they'll keep trying to mine the data. But yes, if we don't keep up with the data, we'll miss our targets for releasing the data to the rest of the community. So yes, that's a really good way to look at it.
We're going to take a short break here, Sarah. This
sure.
is Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, talking to Sarah Seeger, Professor of Astrophysics at MIT, and we'll be back in one brief moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Bringing a sick child to the doctor can be challenging enough, but a fatal diagnosis is absolutely heartbreaking. Each year, 300 children under 10 in America will learn that they have DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma. Survival is just 1 year.
This type of cancer arises from brain cells called glia. Their duties include providing the myelin covering surrounding the nerves to insulate them and ensure speedy transmission of signals.
The glial cells that become cancerous in DIPG are in the deepest area of the brain, called the brainstem, which regulates breathing, blood pressure, and heart rate.
Now scientists have identified a molecule that stops the growth of this aggressive brain tumor. The molecule is called PRC2, vital in regulating the expression of other genes. Without it, certain cells can grow uncontrollably.
The mutation in DIPG may be keeping PRC2 from suppressing genes that keep cells in an immature state. These cells should be maturing into specific cells, and when they don't, they can become the most aggressive tumors.
To test whether PRC2 activity is important in these tumors, the scientists develop a molecule called JQ1 that binds to and inhibits the action of PRC2.
They then injected human DIPG cells into the brainstems of mice. Once the mice developed tumors, they were treated with JQ1 for 10 days. There was a dramatic decrease in tumor size.
JQ1 even reversed the dysregulation of gene expression and shut down the genes that cause the cells to grow out of control. Though still in lab testing, this offers the first hope to DIPG patients that their cancer is survivable. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Sarah Seeger from MIT, Professor of Astrophysics, talking about her fascination and love of and career with astronomy. And Russell, you were going to ask a question.
Yeah, looking at the write-up here, NASA is developing something called Starshade, which helps block the light of stars so telescopes can better look at the exoplanets. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, let me first finish about the transiting planets just by saying that transiting planets, you know, are not the end of the story because, you know, they have to be specially aligned. And a lot of stars, we believe that like all stars have planets, or almost all stars have planets, but we would really like to be able to find planets around the very nearest stars. You know, the ones that you could look, you can see them from Texas, you know, the ones you could look up in the night sky and see. But they may not have a transiting planet, you know, so the question is what next? And it turns out for very, very small planets, like Earth, Earth is really considered, it doesn't seem small to us, right? Because the distance from Texas to Boston, it's actually, it feels like it's super far. But Earth is one of the smaller planets that we can find out there. And, you know, my whole goal, and many people in the community, it's our goal to find a planet that's the size of Earth, orbiting a star like our sun. And for that, we have to go to space. And we have to get above the blurring effects of Earth's atmosphere. And because the nearest stars, you know, are unlikely to have a transiting Earth, we actually have this new technique. It's not really that new, but it's called the coronagraph or the starshade. But let me just back up 1 second here. I'm not sure, did either of you see the solar eclipse, the total solar eclipse we just had a few weeks ago in August 2017?
We didn't get a total one here, but several years ago I went down to La Paz to see a total eclipse down there with a totality of over 7 minutes, which is getting close to the max. So
that's
we have
phenomenal.
Seen them. It was wonderful.
And so is the next one that's coming in 2024. It seems that I wonder how far you are away from that one, from totality.
That's going to be down in East Texas, I believe.
Well, I hope that people will make the trip out there from west right. to East Texas because it's just phenomenal. Well, the solar eclipse, you know, when the moon fully blocks the sun, you can see the corona. It's this kind of hot plasma of the sun that extends out really far. Well, in the 1920s and 30s, a French astronomer named Leo, he actually invented something so he could see a corona anytime he wanted to, and he called it the coronagraph. And it's like a device, like a stop you put inside your telescope, and it blocks out the sun so you can see the corona using your telescope. Well, now people use that to find exoplanets. They block out the starlight with a very specialized coronagraph inside the telescope, and they can block out the starlight and see planets directly. But those planets are not close to the star. They tend to be like a big, hot Jupiter really far from the star that still is massive and still hot from its birth. And we need to apply this better and better and better if we want to be able to find anything like Earth orbiting a star like our sun. So one of the ideas, it actually came about in the 1960s, was don't put like a little tiny, you know, circle or special object inside your telescope. Why not make a giant screen? A giant screen. It's kind of like the moon blocking the sun, right? It's this huge, huge screen that would block out the starlight, and then a separate telescope somewhere far away from the starshade, but also in space, would receive the light from the planet only. So I want you to imagine a screen, a specially shaped screen, tens of meters in diameter. And this screen, you know, for flying so far, tens of thousands of kilometers away from its telescope, both of them in space, really far away from Earth's gravity. And that's the concept called starshade. It was thought about in the 1960s. Every decade or so, it was sort of revived in some way. And finally today, in, you know, nearly 2020, we're actually able to think about building it and launching it, stowing it, deploying it, launching it, and trying to get it to function.
And so when you find these exoplanets, then what's the big thrust? To find out what the atmosphere is there? That I gather you would use infrared spectroscopy for this as opposed to visual.
What about life on the planet?
Well, we're hoping that some of these planets have life. And people are, you know, I would say struggling, you know, to think of what is our best approach here. Now, I think you just mentioned the infrared, where most molecules are active. They rotate and vibrate, and they have really nice features the way they interact with light. They produce great spectra. But the infrared isn't somewhere we can look right now. And that is because, actually, there's two different reasons. But one of them is we need to spatially separate the planet and star on the sky. And actually, how you can, you know, if you look at an object, imagine you're looking at a binary star in the sky and you want to see both components of the star with your telescope, you know, the bigger the telescope, the more likely you are to separate them. And in fact, we have a formula based on diffraction, and it's related to the wavelength of light over the diameter of the telescope. So as your wavelength grows, you actually need to be able to have your telescope bigger and bigger. And if you're at long wavelengths in the infrared, your telescope has to be so big you couldn't build a single telescope to do the job. So right now, people all want to work at visible wavelengths where you could have a smaller telescope. And invisible, you're not seeing those giant molecular features that are so rich in the infrared. But nonetheless, there still are features. There's water vapor, and there's oxygen, and there's other gases we can try to see in reflected light at visible wavelengths.
So you could actually see water vapor visually? How does that work?
Because water vapor has some combination bands that come in bluer wavelengths, not like at 500 nanometers, but they're like at 700, 800, 900 nanometers, 1 micron. So it's kind of in the red part of the spectrum, but not infrared, which we call, in astronomy anyway, we call infrared like 1 micron or 5 microns and longer. That was a bit of a digression, though. But let's just say the whole goal that the astronomy community has is, yes, is to find a planet, to look in its atmosphere, and to see water vapor, which on a small rocky planet like Earth shouldn't have water vapor unless there's a liquid water ocean, a big reservoir to you know, let that water vapor form in the atmosphere. And right now, all life as we know it needs liquid water. So it's sort of very, you know, terracentric, but we're looking for water because we think that could be a planet that could be inhabited.
Yeah, but there is one of the satellites of one of the major planets that has water vapor on it. And they're thinking, well, there were oceans on Mars, and now in some of these other places, there are places where they think there's water.
They think there's water subsurface, yeah. And there's a whole different branch of planetary science that works on solar system planets and thinking of ways to send probes there.
Yep.
Yeah, there's Enceladus, one of Saturn's moons. There's many of Jupiter's moons. So there's a lot of... Yeah, I think I would say it's fair to say there's hope that there's some kind of life somewhere else in our solar system.
I remember we had a physics professor here a few years ago that teamed up with a geologist and made all sorts of hypothetical ideas about life based upon, for example, silicon. And therefore, all of a sudden, water wasn't such a big, heavy requirement. Are you thinking along those lines too, or is that just a bit too far away?
Well, people are definitely thinking along the lines of, you know, why water vapor? Why not something else?
Right.
And I think now the trend is moving towards any liquid will do. People still envision requiring some kind of liquid for, you know, chemicals around you to react with each other to make a solvent so that chemicals can break apart and reform and build more complex molecules, or just trying over and over again in the so-called try to create some,
well, that's,
you know, chemicals that lead to life.
That's right, because, I mean, I'm a chemist. And so we avoid water, in fact, in my laboratory.
I know, that's right.
We
I've
like
heard
that. SO2 is a very water. Nice material, or fluorohydrocarbons, but water, we don't need it to do interesting chemistry. And at basis, life is chemistry.
Well, one thing, though, is that when we tie that thought together with astronomy, we're sort of depressingly back to square one, because if you want to ask, you know, think about the phase diagram of temperature and pressure and where any chemical you're interested in is liquid. Water still has a very broad range of pressures and temperatures where it's liquid. And when we look around at planets and planetary environments based on the building blocks of planets, you know, we don't have the luxury you have in the lab to isolate some kind of liquid or use a tiny amount of what you're interested in. We only have those big reservoirs of things out there, and there really aren't too many liquids, if you think of planets, that could be on the surface. So we have Titan, for example, which has hydrocarbon lakes. That's phenomenal. But, you know, going inwards and thinking about the different temperatures and surface pressures, we're honestly very hard-pressed to come up with any liquids.
What about giants, photosynthetic birds that have leaves as wings? That's a quote from you.
Yes, it's all possible, but not necessarily possible.
But it certainly sounds very good. I mean, that's a lovely image. But
let's just hold on to this thought for one more second, because
Okay. Yes,
I mean, an exoplanet, anything's possible. And we do want to keep our minds open to what's out there, but still working within the framework of the tools we have.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Scientists tend to sort of travel down tram lines of empirical fact and not so often look to the left and to the right. And I think that's a cautionary story or a cautionary tale that you've just given us. However, Sarah, however big space is, 30 minutes is still 30 minutes on the radio, and we've run out of our 30 minutes. So I'd like to thank you, Sarah Seeger from MIT, Professor of Astrophysics, graduate of the University of Toronto. I've got to throw that in. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was a fun program, and we'd like to thank you for listening, and I'd like to thank Lauren Terrasas, our producer this week, for another interesting show. We'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.